Elwood pointed out to me that I should point out to you that if you would like to have copies of this document, the Commission on Preservation and Access, Magnetic Tape Storage and Handling, A Guide for Libraries and Archives by the National Media Lab. These are sitting outside in a box as you're coming into the door. If you see them, don't run out and get them now, but if you, you know, on another break or something, you'll run out and get them. All right? If you leave now, you'll miss this great program. This is a really, really good one. They've all been really good, but this one's really good. Whatever that means. I don't, but I'm a jazz fan, so yeah. Well, I got to say that. I know Patricia Willits. She'll hurt me if I don't say nice things about her. She's really very nice, as is everybody on this panel. Boy, am I getting into it. Okay. All right. I'm going to introduce two of these folks, only because I don't have an intro for the third one, but that's not his fault. He's been very busy. Larry Applebaum is a senior studio engineer at... here, in the Library of Congress, a motion picture, broadcasting, recorded sound division. And Patricia Willard is the Gershwin consultant on jazz and popular music, also here. And she's a jazz oral historian, a research consultant, a writer, a photographer, and just a damn nice person. And they're going to place, oh, and John Newsom, who I guess they'll tell you more about, or he'll tell you more about, will also be... telling you about the wonderful jazz treasures here at the Library of Congress. He's the chief of the music division, John Newsom. Recognize the chief.
Acting. Thank you. I will try to be brief because I want to give Patricia plenty of time, I will try to be available if you have any questions after the whole session. Several points of how we do these things. I think historically you should know that the collecting of jazz is not a totally new phenomenon in the music division or in the library. The first acquisitions in jazz really came through copyright. In 1909, the copyright law provided for the deposit, not of sound recordings, but of unpublished works in music, which meant that we began to get in blues and later in jazz very important items in the form of handwritten lead sheets. As the recording business picked up, but recordings were not copyrightable, artists and their companies decided that to protect themselves, it was a good idea to get things in this unpublished registration regulation, and did so. As a result, we have lead sheets from Bessie Smith recording sessions, from Louis Armstrong, from Lil Hardin, and probably the most important, in a way, are the number of deposits from Jelly Roll Morton. These came first in conjunction with his own recordings and composition process, and were gathered together in those famous at that famous time in 1938 when Alan Lomax got together with Morton and made these historic recordings in the Coolidge Auditorium. At that time, they went through the copyright deposits that they were able to gather of these unpublished works, and Morton initialed those that he acknowledged to be in his own handwriting, so we have his own testimony as to what was really his and what may have been done by a copyist. The jazz collections continued over the years. I think the most significant single donation before my arrival in the library in 1966 was the Charlie Barnett Orchestra collection, which has now been the subject of some attention by several scholars, and I hope will in not too many years enable us to start a publication of some of the outstanding works there. In the very recent years, we have become focused in a way that we were not focused in aggressively going after potential donors to save what would otherwise not be saved, of jazz on paper and on tape and in any other recorded medium, and on film for that matter, any other recorded medium available. There are several things I should say about this program. One of them is that they're based on our view that the library is the most appropriate place for the deposit of these collections. I think because of, number one, our superb preservation programs, not only in recorded sound, but probably less known to most of you, in paper preservation. The Paper Conservation Office is one of the outstanding institutions of its kind in the world, and is able to bring to bear the expertise of their staff on all kinds of serious deterioration problems on paper and other paper and binding and so on. We are also, I think this is very important to stress, determined to become a disseminator of the collections and not merely a depository. I think we've all heard complaints that the Library of Congress is a place that where things simply sit on the shelf. In the last few years, as the result of a very effective proposal to Congress by the librarian James Billington, we have increased the staff for processing collections by a significant number of people. In the music division alone, we have an authorized increase of 25 positions in the last 3 years. And this means that we can not only go after collections, but make real promises about how quickly they can be processed and made available for study in the reading rooms, and how quickly we can also work on outreach. The principal problem with outreach, I think, is besides money, and that's not the main issue, is rights. We do not have the right to most of the material we acquire. When we go to a composer, the assumption is that we solicit the physical material that we will preserve, but we will not acquire the rights to the material. We don't have any intellectual rights in the property. We have to negotiate with recording companies, with publishers, as well as the estates or the composers themselves. And it is in this area I hope that the library will be able to take some significant role of leadership. We have no problem with disseminating or having our collections disseminated through commercial means, if that is the most efficient and best way to do it from the standpoint of the artist as well as the library. But we are also exploring ways in which the library can underwrite production and distribution of material using its reputation among owners of rights to bring together under the same cover different works owned by different people. Some of you are aware of situations in which a record company, or say several record companies, own important works of a single composer in jazz or a single improviser or a single artist. The problem of getting all of the different works together in an anthology is sometimes daunting, at least for commercial publishers who are not able to negotiate getting all the rights of everybody else's music on their record. We hope to be able to do this both in printed anthologies of music as well as in recorded projects. Another and my last major point before are in the process of introducing Patricia Willard is in the area of how we approach donors and how we think it's most appropriate to do so. We want to approach any potential donor or seller with an honest picture of what they can expect from the library. This means that the donor has to trust what we say and not feel that we are simply making the situation look rosy when it may not be, and then getting the stuff on the shelf and doing what too frequently has happened in the past with various institutions, and that is let the acquired collection gather dust. When we hired Patricia Willard as Gershwin consultant in jazz, we hired her, of course, First, because she is one of the outstanding authorities in jazz, has a long career as a writer and a superb researcher who knows what she is talking about and who is respected by people who read what she writes. But in addition to her stature as a jazz expert, she has worked in the business and has gained the trust through many years of close personal association of some of the major artists, many of the people also who are operative in the whole jazz business but are not themselves well known, whose opinion of the library and of what we say counts tremendously in what we are able to acquire. Patricia has that trust, and it is through that connection that she's been able to negotiate some very important deposits, donations, and is continuing to do so for us. And I think I will turn it over to Patricia, who will talk about some of the things we've acquired, and we'll hold them up for you as we talk about them. Patricia.
Thank you. The library's commitment to jazz, as John has just described, is a steadily expanding one, and the diversity of our collections is really very impressive, I think. And when we, for example, acquire the collection of a jazz composer, we may archive her or his music manuscripts, photographs, scrapbooks, audio and video recordings, films, correspondence, and other significant memorabilia. And some of that memorabilia has been absolutely fascinating. But one of the things, not auxiliary material in this case, but we have here from the Charlie Barnett collection, his entire music library, one particular score for a number called A Million Dreams Ago. And while it may not be the most significant composition or number that he ever played, there's wonderful insights into the band. The band, of course, was very well respected, high quality, but it was also a good time band. Everybody enjoyed themselves, and there's probably a dozen little private jokes all on this score. The end of the score, there is a notation where one complete staff is crossed out and rewritten in pencil at the bottom, and it says, make a B instead of a C sharp. Watch it, Duke. Presumably, this may have been one of the ones that Barnett got from Duke Ellington, although in checking the Ellington discography, Ellington never had A Million Dreams Ago. Several years later, he did do something 100 dreams ago. But the parts, interestingly, I think, are marked, they may have the most fun with the trumpeters. Billy May's part is marked Wilhelm May. Bernie Priven's, Bernie, who spelled it B-E-R-N-I-E, his part is marked B-U-R-N-K-N-E-E. And Lyman Vunk's part is L-Y-E-M-A-N. And they had two endings for the guitar part only, for one for stage, one for dance band. And the arrangement was by Louis Bud Estes, who somebody penciled in Buffy Boy on, and that was the name of a Barnett composition later. So there's someone doing Barnett research could get a lot of insights into the relationships of the band just from studying these wonderful scores. So that's an added plus. In the case of the copyright deposits that we are fortunate to have in the same building here, we had an Italian film scholar visit us a few months ago who was intent on finding the Duke Ellington score for Anatomy of a Murder, and he found it in the copyright collection, but it was so extensive he couldn't absorb it all here. He wanted a copy to take back to Italy. And, of course, we can't copy copyrighted material without permission of the copyright holder. So we called Mercer Ellington, Duke Ellington's son and the executor of the estate, and asked if he would be willing to grant permission to this man from Italy to have a copy of it. And Mercer Ellington was so excited to know that the complete score existed because he didn't realize it was here on copyright deposit. He said, absolutely, if I can have a copy too. So he faxed us his permission, and everybody was happy. So it's wonderful to be able to provide that kind of service. We have the Louis Belson collection, and John and I pulled out a very impressive example of Louis' music. This is a score for symphonies. It's called Symphony in Jazz Americana. It has been performed with several major symphonies in the United States. The Belson collection of music is extensive, and we're so delighted to receive it, but on the other hand, Mr. Belson is so delighted to have it here because his brother had been archiving it in a shed in his backyard, and we were worried about the preservation of the music. So it is here, and it will eventually be joined by all of the research materials for his autobiography that I'm working with him on, all the tape-recorded interviews and the photographs and all of the other Belson material. We have here a photocopy of UB Blake's Overture to Shuffle Along, 1921. The notation is that whereabouts of the original manuscript are unknown, but we do have a photocopy, which is something that's valuable to have, because Shuffle Along, of course, was the Broadway show, which was a big hit. It had I think UB Blake's first hit song, I'm Just Wild About Harry, in it, and so that's another prize. We have the Ed Beach collection. Ed Beach was a highly respected disc jockey on WRVR in New York for many years, and we have hundreds of his radio broadcasts. We have them from Ahmed Abdul Malik, the bass player, to Denny Zeitlin, the pianist. And these include on-air interviews, historical information from the very well-informed Mr. Beach, as well as tapes of the whole entire program. We have the Yvonne Irvin collection. She's a journalist and broadcaster in Tucson, Arizona, and the president of the Tucson Jazz Society. And she has donated to us her interviews with Brian Bromberg, Louis Belson, Billy Taylor, producer-engineer Ed Michelle, Betty Carter, Stanley Turrentine, Mel Lewis, Pete Chrisley, John McLaughlin, Al Demiola, John Schofield, Joanne Brekeen, Chick Corea, and Pat Metheny, which brings us into the more contemporary areas. We have Med Flory, the leader of Super Sax, has deposited here all of the Super Sax scores. And there we have a confirmation in Med's own hand. Med transcribed the original solos and did the arrangements for the group. We have the Buddy Collette collection, which is still in the process of arriving. And not only is it Buddy's compositions and arrangements, but we have a great deal of getting a great deal of film and videotape on Buddy. And we will have a copy of the 22-hour oral history he did with the UCLA archives. So that is a collection that continues to grow. And Buddy, we're presenting in concert next June at the Lincoln Theater, along with concerts by another donor, Gerald Wilson, who's a major composer, whose career goes back all the way to Jimmy Lunsford. And Gerald is gradually sending in his music, and also we've done a five-hour beginning of an oral history with Gerald. We have a developing oral history program, which is collection-related, and if there is not a significant amount of oral history material on a donor, then we try to augment whatever exists. We have the Jerry Mulligan collection, which is just arriving now. We have the Fred Katz collection, the cellist who plays and writes in both jazz and classical music. He was once a cellist with the National Symphony here. Fred is sending in his material, and we've done a five-hour oral history with Fred. We have the famous Charles Mingus collection, and one of his scores, The Shoes of the Fisherman's Wife, is here. This is an enormous collection. And in Mingus, that one is in Mingus's hand. Some of them are in the hands of copyists or arrangers. The Mingus collection consists of original manuscripts, arrangers' scores, instrumental parts, recordings, literary manuscripts, that is the total manuscript, including the unpublished portions of his autobiography, Beneath the Underdog. We have photographs and other documents. With Stephen Longstreet, who was not necessarily immediately thought of as a jazz name, did do three books, one of poetry called Jazz Solos, and another book, From Storyville to Harlem and Magic Trumpets, The Young People's Story of Jazz. But he was an exceptional artist also and had exhibits internationally. And we have his collection of watercolors, which he called Jazz Age Revisited, and they're very, very impressive. Tommy Newsom has just signed an agreement with us. He'll be sending in his music. It's not here yet. And we have the Jerry Valburn collection, which is the world's largest and most complete collection of Ellington recordings, which Larry can talk about as from recorded sound. But in addition to it, his auxiliary materials consist of some correspondence. He collected everything he could get his hands on of Ellington. A great many interesting photographs, souvenir programs, and many, many print materials. And then we have like spillovers from other divisions, which is quite interesting. We've just acquired the Gordon Parks collection. And he has written material, for instance, the score for Shaft's Big Score had a song which became popular by the jazz singer O.C. Smith. And his film, which is on the Librarian of Congress's first list of films to be preserved here, his film, The Learning Tree, which has a performance in it by Jimmy Rushing. So we're all interrelated in the various divisions here, which is it's kind of exciting. The manuscript division has jazz material, and we work with each other, and especially to the service of researchers. I think I've used up our time, and it is now my pleasure to reintroduce Larry Applebaum, as Vincent said, senior studio engineer in motion picture broadcasting and recorded sound, and host on Sunday evenings at 5 p.m. if you're in the Washington area of his program Sound of Surprise on WPFW. And Larry also is the producer of the Library of Congress Jazz Film Series, which will be beginning next month and run through December, which is going to be very exciting, and I think Larry may tell you something about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. Good morning, everyone. Let's say you're a musician or writer or historian, and you want to research the jazz collections here at the library. Presumably, you've already been through the music division. You might next want to explore the jazz holdings in the motion picture broadcast and recorded sound division. I'd suggest we start with recorded sound, and we'll move on to film and video. The first thing I'd encourage you to do is to start with some of the special collections in the recorded sound section, specifically the NBC Radio collection, Robert Altshuler collection, the collections of Voice of America, Wally Heider, Jerry Valburn, the Armed Forces Radio Service, the Jelly Roll Morton collection, the V-discs, and don't forget the copyright deposits. One of the most important sources for unissued jazz performances is the NBC Radio collection, which came to the library in 1978. Sam Brolowski and our staff gave you some details on that yesterday afternoon. Let me just reemphasize, it's over 175,000 acetate transcriptions, roughly from the years early 30s to late 60s. Of course, it contains everything that was broadcast, not just jazz. News to sports, soap operas to quiz shows, but there's also a cross-section of the kind of jazz and big band music that was being broadcast during those years. And within the NBC collection, the first places you'll want to look are programs like Hear America Swinging, Music for Moderns, All-Star Parade of Bands, Stars in Jazz. One of my favorites was the Chamber Music Society of Lower Basin Street with, what was the name, Hot Lips Levine and its Woodwindy 10. The Hollywood Bowl concerts were being broadcast by NBC. Nat King Cole had a very hip 15-minute program with lots of jazz soloists called King Cole Trio Time, sponsored by Wild Root Cream Oil, you remember. Frank Sinatra, while not strictly a jazz singer, had a wonderful 15-minute program broadcast again in the late 40s called Perfectly Frank. It's been bootlegged over the years. We have clean copies of that, and hopefully that'll get issued at some point. We can keep our fingers crossed. There are also many DJ shows, jazz DJ shows, among the better ones, Dave Garraway out of Chicago, and he had lots of interviews and guest performances on that program. Before we get too far afield, I want to hear some examples and play for you some brief excerpts from four NBC programs. The first is from August 4, 1940. Imagine after a morning of transferring Fred Waring and you get one of these. Just clears your whole head out. And somebody should tell Phil Schaap about that last one. You heard a little bit about the Robert Altshuler collection yesterday. It was acquired in 1992 and it actually came in the door in 1993. It was the largest private collection of jazz in 78 RPM on disc. It includes over 200,000 of these records of jazz, blues, and pop, primarily between 1900 and 1953. It includes many discs that have never been reissued, and it's nearly triple our holdings of 78s. While it's still being processed, we've so far found over 30 black swans and even a black patty. I think it's our first black patty in our collection. It's also got some test pressings, it's got acetates, and there are hundreds of autographed discs. Imagine pulling out Fletcher Henderson record with his autograph. We've got autographs from Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Armstrong, Albert Ammons, Ethel Waters, the Mills Brothers, and many, many more. By the way, I'd encourage you, if you're going to be around tomorrow, there's going to be a tour throughout the collections here. Stop down to G12, and you can see the jazz SWAT team processing the Altshuler collection. SWAT, yeah, they are sweaty. Sweaty SWAT team. Another resource for unissued jazz performances are found in the Voice of America collection. Obviously, they were intended for shortwave, so they're almost all mono tapes. The vast majority of them are on acetate, 7 and 10 inch. The jazz materials within the VOA collection include Montreux Jazz Festival. We've got almost 100 reels of that from the early 70s. We have about 200 reels of the Monterey Jazz Festival from 65 to 83. We've got the DC International Jazz Festival. We have the Jazz at the White House tapes. We have the Cool Jazz Festival, over 300 reels of that. We've got the New York Jazz Repertory Orchestra from the mid-70s, a series called Roots of Jazz from 1956, the Sacramento Jazz Festival. We've got Willis Conover's World of Jazz, over 200 reels of that. And speaking of Willis, we've got at least 30 of his interviews with people like Nat Cole and Duke Ellington and Earl Garner and many, many more. Probably the most surreal series of tapes within those VOA collections are three reels done by Jack Teagarden in Bombay, in which he jams with local Indian musicians. But probably the most important, certainly the most significant of the VOA tapes are the Newport Jazz Festival. I've been working on those tapes, transferring them, reformatting them for the last year or so. We've got over 400 reels of them from 1955. For some reason, we don't have any tapes from the first year, 54, but we have everything from about 55 to 61. It gets a little spotty in the mid-60s, and then it resumes again when the festival moved to New York in 71. I wanted to play, actually I'd love to play a lot of selections and excerpts from that collection, because it constitutes a virtual, it's a history of post-World War II jazz in this country. And so many of the performances have never been heard in the States unless you were at the concert. They were intended for overseas audiences. There are two I want to mention and one excerpt I want to play for you. The two I want to mention involve Duke Ellington. One is a 1962 concert in which Thelonious Monk sits in on the piano. And it's just an amazing, he only does two numbers. But to hear Monk playing Duke's part on an arrangement by Billy Strayhorn is mind-blowing. He does Monk's Dream and Frère Monk. The second thing is the famous 1956 performance of Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue. How many of you have heard that? That's very famous Columbia Records, maybe among the top-selling jazz records of all time. If you listen to it, when you go back home and listen to it again, notice how sort of distant the tenor saxophone solo is. It's because Paul Gonzalez played his entire solo in front of the wrong microphone. He ignored the NBC solo mic and played his entire solo, astounding solo, in front of the Voice of America mic. So the one thank God for those engineers at VOA, and thank God we've got a tape of it, because it sounds like a blanket's been lifted off it. It's an amazing performance. Hopefully it will see the light of day. A few people have heard it, and the reaction is uniformly great. One excerpt I do want to play, perhaps the rarest of rare that I have found so far in the Newport Festival collection, is this excerpt from 1955. Miles Davis had just been winding down his contract with Prestige Records. He had cleaned himself up physically and health-wise. He was sounding really great. He was going to be in between record deals, and he performed at this festival, and it turned everybody on, and it led to his signing with Columbia Records. Nobody seemed to know that this tape exists. It's mentioned in various biographies of Miles, but it's never even been bootlegged. That's how rare it is. We're going to play one. Very good. The tape is in pretty good shape. The group is also fairly strange, to think of Zoot Sims playing with Miles Davis, with Jerry Mulligan, Connie Kay, Percy Heath, Thelonious Monk is at the piano. In fact, I want to play an excerpt of Miles Davis playing, there's nobody who played a ballad like Miles. He'll play Round Midnight, accompanied by the composer and pianist, Thelonious Monk.
Thelonious Monk is going to play Round About Midnight.
Wally Heider is to radio transcriptions what Jacques Cousteau is to exotic fish. He was a recording engineer. Actually, originally he was an attorney, but we won't hold that against him. He was a recording engineer. He ran Hindsight Records. He issued many rare swing-era big band recordings, many that he recorded himself with his own mobile studio. His collection came here in 1979. He was friends with Bob Carneal, my former boss in the recording lab. Heider's collection includes 1,900 discs and 1,350 audio tapes, 10-inch reels. Most of them have been unissued. They're unpublished, and they're here waiting. So, Jerry Valburn, we heard Patricia talk about Jerry. Many of you know Jerry. He's the kind of collector archivists love, not for his sweet disposition, but rather for the fact that he's a completist. His collection contains a copy of every recording that Duke Ellington ever released commercially, and thousands of unreleased open reel tapes. There are more than 5,000 tapes and discs in all, as well as ETs, acetates, film, video, photos, and programs. A couple other collections before we move to the video. AFRS, which is here, established in 1942. The programs that you'll find jazz on include Spotlight Bands, One Night Stand, G.I. Jive, Command Performance, and especially Jubilee, which featured primarily black performers. Now, a lot of these consisted of commercially issued recordings, but many were live performances commissioned by AFRS. We've also got the a copy, I think, of every V disc, maybe Sam will confirm that, every V disc ever released. We've got two Jelly Roll Morton collections. One are the oral histories that were mentioned yesterday and again today, recorded across the street in the Coolidge Auditorium. We've also got a small box set that Ahmet Erdogan donated to the library in memory of his brother Nesawi. It's every commercial 78 Jelly Roll Morton ever made in a nice box set. Don't forget the copyright deposits. The library is the copyright deposit library for the United States, and we've been getting scores of just many, many commercial discs, especially since 1973 when the copyright laws were rewritten. But on to video. One of the challenges for years in finding, we always had many, many gems in the film and video collection here at the library, but it was always difficult to find them because they were cataloged by title, not by subject. For example, there's a Miles Davis film done with Gil Evans and John Coltrane and others. Most people think the name of it is The Sound of Miles, but it's really called the Robert Herridge Theater, and unless you looked under Robert in the catalog, you would not know that it existed and that we had a copy here in the library. Fortunately, in 1993, a junior fellow named Rebecca Clear compiled an annotated guide to the jazz on film and video in the Library of Congress. This is indispensable. It's on reference in our motion picture reading room. Anybody wanting to do research is going to want to start here. There are over 600 documentaries, TV shows, concert performances, theatrical features, and short subjects, and various compilations of all types listed here. It's also got an index, a performer index, which really makes things a lot easier. Since we really can't show film today, I wanted to concentrate on some video. The first is a clip from the Steve Allen Show, not the early 50s series that he did for CBS, but this is mid-50s that he did for NBC. This is also very rare in that he takes the cameras on location to Birdland. You'll see him for a short appearance with Count Basie's orchestra from 1956. And pay attention, as he gets to the bottom of the stairs, he's greeted by a very short man, legendary in jazz circles. His name was Pee Wee Marquette. He was the MC at Birdland. And musicians say that unless you gave him a healthy tip at the start of the engagement, he would mispronounce your name every night until you did. So you'll hear soloists like Frank West and Joe Newman, and I hope it's Al Gray. I think it's Al Gray. Let's roll the first video from July 22nd, 1956.
Of the entertainment world, around which are clustered movie houses.
Another clip I want to show from 1956, and it is an extraordinary excerpt from an omnibus program. The series ran between 52 and 59. The producer of the omnibus was our former division chief of the Motion Picture Broadcast and Recorded Sound Division, Robert Sawdeck. Fortunately, Mr. Sawdeck was able to get a hold of the original kinescopes from Wesleyan. They came here, we made 1-inch preservation masters, and then 3/4-inch viewing copies of pretty much the entire run. This next clip from December 2nd, 1956, two drummers, Joe Jones, not to be confused with Philly Joe Jones, Joe Jones, the great swing era drummer, and Chatur Lal, the great Indian tabla player. They encounter each other. In the band, behind them you'll see Tony Scott, Ruby Braff, a I think that's Walter Page on bass, and maybe somebody can help me identify the pianist on this.
And we're going to see if they can blend by having the whole group.
Yeah, as Patricia was saying, the facial our expressions are as good as the performance. They're part of the performance, no question. We're going to have to jettison the very last example I wanted to show, which was one of the NET programs. We have over 10,000 tapes that came from PBS. They include all the national educational television broadcasts from mid-50s up till about 1970 or so. There's some amazing music performances, not just jazz, but classical and folk and everything else you can imagine. There was one I wanted to play called Music USA, that's a series, and that episode was The Experimenters with Cecil Taylor and Charles Mingus. But I think we do have time for one last very brief, the briefest of brief clips from the Monterey Jazz Festival, 1967. The first thing you'll see is Jimmy Lyon smoking a cigarette. He was the one who created the Monterey Jazz Festival. He was the producer. You'll see Carmen McRae singing this gorgeous ballad, and then somebody we'll all recognize comes, sneaks up behind her for a surprise appearance. Let me close on one last note. Newt Gingrich may tap his foot on the 1 and 3, but the library is starting to swing. Thank you very much.